Anna Goldsworthy, welcome to the music show. And congratulations on this fine book, Piano Lessons. Perhaps I should start with the obvious question, which is, why did you decide to write this?
Well, it wasn't actually my decision, Andrew. I was approached by the publisher at Black Ink, Chris Fike, a couple of years ago. He happened to send me an email on my birthday, and it was, in retrospect, a very nice birthday present. I'd been writing the occasional article for The Monthly, and he'd read those articles and thought perhaps I might have a book in me. And his suggestion was that I might consider writing a type of musical memoir. And I remember thinking, oh, no, I couldn't possibly do that. That's terribly presumptuous. You know, I'm only sort of starting out my career. I'm not in any position to sit down and write the definitive autobiography. But then I got thinking about it, and I'd always wanted to write about my teacher, Eleonora Sivan, and it occurred to me that this could be a good way to go about that. And at the same time, it might be a useful exercise for me to clarify some of my own thoughts about music. And also write in a way without a guilty conscience. Sometimes when I'm writing, I sort of think, well, I should really be practicing. But this was, to my mind, a lovely way of bringing the two disciplines together.
Yes, that's right. And then you've got two sorts of procrastination, haven't you?
That's right.
The practicing that you can do when you should be writing.
Exactly.
And
it's, yeah. And it's amazing how much work you get done when you're procrastinating about something else.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. Well, let's wind back to before Mrs. Sivan,
yeah.
Because there is a little bit in the book before you meet her.
Yeah.
What did music mean to you when you were a little girl,
yeah.
And before you met this inspirational teacher?
Well, I was always quite passionate about it. My ultimate dream, and it's a bit embarrassing to admit this, was to appear on Young Talent Time, which I was obsessed with. And I used to try and catch my parents out and, you know, just casually say to them, do you think maybe I might be on Young Talent Time one day? Because I had a notion that I had a beautiful voice, which, alas, I don't. And each time I asked them that, they were a little bit evasive or even said to me outrightly, no, darling, I don't think you will. You can't sing. But they did encourage me to keep on practicing the piano. And I think that was actually the way I was drawn into music to start with. And then there was always a piano in the house growing up. And, you know, my grandparents would play and my parents would play, some of them better than others. They're all amateur musicians, I guess, and it just seemed like a natural progression for me to begin piano lessons too.
Yes, so it was just something that happened in your family.
It was, I think, yeah.
But there's a huge difference, of course, between doing something because the family does it, everybody does it, and doing something, you know, for a living.
Yes,
as your way of life.
Yes, there is.
Well, we'll come to that, but tell us about your first impressions of Mrs. Sivan.
Oh, I think I was completely overwhelmed. I remember it was my grandfather had come across her. He'd been a district superintendent for the education department, and she'd only just arrived from Russia and was teaching at Woodville High School in the western suburbs of Adelaide, and he'd just chanced upon her on one of his inspections and decided that I had to learn from her, and apparently told her that in no uncertain terms, and also told my father, who resisted at first, but then came round to the idea. And so I found myself one Saturday morning, I think it was, being driven to Eleonora's house by my grandfather.
How old were you?
9. And arrived at the front door, and she opened the front door, And I think I was overwhelmed. Her energy, there is an urgency, I think, to music inside her. It sort of demands to be expressed. It just sort of pours out of her. There's a sort of copiousness to her talent. And for this slightly shy and reticent Australian 9-year-old, this type of effusiveness about music and enthusiasm was quite overwhelming.
Yeah, because I think with any child who is a bit interested in music or even very interested in music, but nevertheless is a child, when you meet somebody who is so passionate and so completely consumed by music, it can be quite shocking, can't it? You realise that there's an enormous gulf.
It can, rather. Yeah, there's nothing casual about it. There was no sense of music being a hobby about it. When from that moment, it was clear to me that if you're talking about music, you're talking about it as something that's of central importance in life.
Yeah. So was that intimidating as well for
yes.
you? Did you ever think, God, I don't think I really want to do this?
Oh, I did sometimes. Not frequently. I really loved the piano and I loved music, but It was a challenge, and I think in retrospect it was probably the most difficult and the most demanding aspect of my childhood, and perhaps that was part of what drew me towards it. There was something in me that I guess that was up for a challenge and wanted to wrestle with this thing that had been thrown in front of me.
Yes, which is, of course, again, something that I think a lot of kids and or their parents feel, but they don't necessarily feel it on a musical level. I mean, there is a sense that it's an accomplishment to be got under your belt, like, you know, swimming and karate.
Sure.
And tennis.
Yeah.
But the idea that you are going to be steeped in music for its own sake and that it will become, as you say, central is another matter, isn't it?
It is. It becomes a way of life. It almost becomes a belief system, I think. It's a vocation that extends to this place where, it's almost a sort of quasi-religion in some ways. Music, for me at least, my experience of music increasingly through my teenage years was the way I came to view my life. And that's perhaps what I've tried to do with this book is recount those memories through the prism of music, which I think was very much the way I was viewing my life at that time.
Mm. Well, so I mean, each of the chapters is called after a composer.
Yeah.
And in that particular chapter, you are studying a particular work or works by the composer whose name is at the front of the chapter. So you are using the music to sort of structure your memoir.
I think so. And I think that's because I used the music at the time, and I think I probably still do, to order my life and to make sense of life. And in that sense, that's what made music, even for me as a child, I think, more than a hobby and something much more central.
How do you do that? How do you order your life?
Through music.
Yes.
Well, in my teenage years, I think it took the form of identifying myself very strongly with these pieces that I was studying and finding a place that I belonged, and also a sanctuary away from some of the difficulties and awkwardnesses of adolescence. These days, look, I think playing the piano is a type of ordering activity, and it brings harmony to existence. It's a beautiful play. If you're playing the classical repertoire, there's an immense reassurance in the notion that dominants are going to return to their tonics. And when you're sort of living in a disorderly modern world, I personally find there is something really nurturing about that. And not only that, even the sort of physical process of piano practice, it offers you this opportunity to be quite obsessive compulsive and dust out every single corner of your pieces and align everything and order everything. And I know when I haven't been practicing, I feel the absence of that. But also beyond that, music offers, I think, an opportunity for, I suppose, emotional release. Mm. And that's the other aspect I find very, very important.
And that's important to a teenager too.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, whether that takes the form of headbanging or yes, conducting Beethoven's Fifth in your lounge room, I think it's extremely important to an adolescent.
Yes. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. My guest is Anna Goldsworthy, the pianist and also the author of a book called Piano Lessons, which is a memoir of her own piano lessons. Your dad used to go to your piano lessons with you.
He did,
a lot
yeah.
of the time and, yeah. and sit and listen.
He did, yeah. Look, I was, in retrospect, extremely fortunate to have a father who took every Tuesday afternoon off work so he could accompany me to my piano lessons. And he did that because he was supportive and also, I think, because he was quite fascinated by my teacher and by what she was inducting me into.
But he didn't wait in the car outside.
No, he was there. And she always emphasised that she liked to have the parents in the room. And I myself find, as a teacher, it really helps to have that supportive parental presence there. So he used to take notes to help me. And over time, those notes sort of started taking the form of a novel, and he converted her into this different character. And finally, eventually, of course, it took the form of his novel Maestro, which became a great success in its own right. And I remember when he first took me aside and showed me what he was doing with those notes, I felt this terrible sense of violation. You know, how dare he? This is highway robbery. And are you going to tell Mrs. Sivan? And he said, no, don't worry. I'll show her if it turns into something. And, of course, eventually he did show her, and she enjoyed the book, and it was published.
I think, though, I wondered about this, whether maybe a child having piano lessons, and particularly a child who's taking them very, very seriously and getting somewhere with them, might feel rather protective of her relationship with her teacher, might not want her dad sort of butting in.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. But I think when I look back at that time, and because after a while Dad stopped coming and it was just became just the two of us, and I think at that moment we developed a different type of relationship and the friendship that we have today. But up until that point, it was very much the three of us in that room together, and I think a very productive time for all three of us. I mean, Eleonora was immensely creative, and her lessons unfold almost as a work of art, and they involve lecture and anecdote and demonstration and improvisation, and they can go for hours. And that's her means of expression. That's where she actually performs her art, is in the context of those piano lessons to this very small, exclusive, and I think privileged audience. It was
she
also,
wasn't performing much.
Not by that stage. No. She had had a wide-ranging performance career in Russia, but since she came to Australia, less so. Dad, meanwhile, it was very inspirational and, you know, sort of became his first novel. So it was terrifically productive and creative from his perspective. And for me, you know, it formed me as a musician. And now I've written a book about it too. So for all three of us, I think it was a wonderfully rich environment. And her lessons were directed towards me, but they were also pitched towards Dad. You know, she's a performer. She likes having an audience, and he was a very receptive audience.
And did she enjoy being the inspiration and, in some senses, the almost the character in Maestro?
Look, I think she did. I think she was puzzled that Dad had turned that character into into an alcoholic. First of all, she said she was surprised that a great musician should be portrayed as an alcoholic. And Keller is a very different character to her, where she's effusive and optimistic and very, very positive. The character of Keller in the book Maestro is the opposite and nowhere near as positive a force. But a lot of her lines he lifted, such as particularly the line that runs as a leitmotif, I think, through the book Maestro, which is, what is the difference between a good pianist and a great pianist? Little bits. This was something that she'd said to me repeatedly as a child, and one of the many things that Dad scribbled into his notebook.
Yes, yes. I must say, reading your book, I had to keep reminding myself that I wasn't reading a novel.
Is that right?
Yeah. There was something about the way in which the characters came to life. I mean, of course, I mean, I know you through your playing, and we've had some conversations, and I know your dad, Peter Goldsworthy, through his poems and his novels, and he's been on the music show a couple of times. Yeah. But I felt I knew you both much, much better from having read the book. And Mrs. Sivan, who I have never met, I felt was a very vivid presence. So in a sense, even though it's a memoir, you are, as a writer, doing something along the same kind of lines that Peter does in a novel.
Yeah, so that's quite true. And it occurred to me as I was writing this that I had to confront that head on. I couldn't sort of deny the fact of Maestro, and I didn't really want people saying, oh, here's Anna Goldsworthy, poor little thing, trying to copy her father's book, because there are sort of issues of ownership there. Who owns that experience? It was my experience. He turned it into a book.
Yes.
If I then reclaim my experience, am I just copying him, or am I allowed to present my own version of events? So as a consequence, I sort of decided I had to draw Maestro into the texture of the book. And it sort of unfolds, I think, kind of slightly polyphonically, and views my own experiences in relation to the experiences of Paul, the young man growing up in Maestro.
Yes.
But it's interesting what you said about reading it as a novel, because even Eleonora, when I gave it to her, she said she became quite involved in the text and forgot that it was about her and me, and actually found herself in a scene towards the end, which is a scene about her in hospital in a very dire situation, found herself actually grieving on my behalf for this poor girl who was suffering because she thought she was going to lose her teacher. And I took that as a tremendous compliment, actually, that she was able to forget that it was about her and forget that it was about me, and instead experience it as a work of art in its own right.
What about you writing it? Were you able to forget to some extent that it was about you?
I think I somebody actually said to me recently that I probably revealed much more than I realised about myself in the writing of this book, and that made me a little bit fearful because I knew I revealed a lot, and the notion that I might have revealed even more was slightly confronting. I don't think I forgot that I was writing about me, but I think perhaps what I did forget was I was writing something that lots of other people would read. So, you know, you write something quite personal and quite private and quite revealing, and you get drawn on to some extent by the intoxication of confession and, you know, by putting things down in paper and reorganising your own past in your head. And then you end up with this document that actually reveals all of your adolescent secrets, and then you release it into the world, and that's where I am now, and it is slightly confronting.
Yes, yes. Let's listen to you play the piano, shall we? I think we should perhaps have a few of the sarcasms of Prokofiev by way of a little sort of sorbet course in this conversation.
Thank you.
There were three of the sarcasms, Opus 17 by Prokofiev, played by Anna Goldsworthy from her ABC Classics CD, Come With Us, Travels With The Piano. And we're talking on today's music show on ABC Radio National to Anna Goldsworthy. She's released a book called Piano Lessons, which is about her adolescence and the lessons that she had and which turned her into the pianist who can play like that. And these lessons were with a Russian pianist. And this is why I thought perhaps we should listen to some Prokofiev, because I think you don't need to know very much about piano playing or classical music to know that there is such a thing as the Russian approach to the piano. And it suggests that, you know, all of these pianists, Emil Gilels and Richter and Rachmaninoff and Mikhail Pletnev, you know, they're all one and the same, really, and they're all Russian and they play in a Russian way. That's obviously not true. But on the other hand, there is a kind of mindset or attitude to the piano, it seems to me, that comes with being Russian. You presumably got a lot of this.
Look, it's hard to know what's the Russian mindset and what's the mindset of the individual who happens to be your teacher. I do think, and I spent a few months, perhaps 10 years ago now, in Moscow, having lessons with a wonderful pedagogue there, Lev Naumov, who was a fellow student of Gilels and Richter, studying with the legendary Heinrich Neuhaus. So I did get some additional insight into what might be termed the Russian school from that experience. But what sort of, I think, strikes me from my experience growing up with Mrs. Sivan, with Eleonora, is something that she often used to say to me, which was that, you know, when she was growing up in Leningrad, there wasn't a lot of opportunity to be a materialistic person because there wasn't a lot to have. And of course, there are immense drawbacks to that. But as a consequence, she felt that people really cultivated their spiritual life. And to this day, if you go to Russia and you play for a Russian audience, there's this sort of warmth and this openness and this receptiveness to music that I think is just about unmatched.
Mm. And again, you're coming back to what you said earlier about a connection between music and, for want of a better word, spirituality.
Yeah, yeah.
This is something that you feel still?
Yeah, oh yeah, I do. I really do. I mean, I think music is a great mystery. It's one of the wonderful mysteries of this life. And there certainly is a particular kind of state you get into sometimes as a performer, and I'm sure even more so as a composer, in which it doesn't feel like it's you playing, really, or it's more like dictation. You've found this place of grace. And I think it is a spiritual place to be in and a spiritual experience.
And it certainly it takes you out of the day-to-day.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Let's talk about some of these other composers that you have named chapters after. I suppose the big one is Bach.
Mm.
Is this a composer who is central to your playing?
Oh, yeah. I really find Bach is the place, like the person, the composer I continually go back to when I need refreshment and replenishment and just need to sort of reset all the parameters and realign myself in music. And so that's why I begin the book, I think, with a chapter on Bach. And I begin its third section, its recapitulation, if you like, also with a chapter on Bach, because Bach is one of these musicians that you return to. You know, and this is the case for everybody. Robert Schumann used to say, make Bach your daily bread and you will surely become a fine musician. Chopin used to play Bach preludes and fugues before going on stage, I think for exactly that same reason, to sort of sluice out his inner hearing, to purify his senses. And I know Pablo Casals, in his beautiful autobiography, Joys and Sorrows, I think it's called, talks about how he begins every day, even though he's a cellist, sitting down at the piano and playing a Bach prelude and fugue, and he considers it a way of blessing the house. It offers a type of benediction.
I won't ask you how it offers a benediction, but I will ask you how it operates as a kind of form of sluicing out.
I think you're forced to listen intently if you're playing the polyphonic music of Bach. I also feel that he's a composer who composes without mannerism, without sentimentality, without any false emotion. And finding that sincerity and finding that peace and that groundedness, I think, is almost a meditational experience.
Yes, I think perhaps more than any other composer that I can think of, I'm not really aware of Bach in the music.
Yeah, exactly. It's not personal music in that sense. He's not elevating his self. And it's not hugely subjective music in that sense. And yet it's so intensely human and it's so intensely reassuring because of that fact.
Yes. Technically, is it also a kind of foundation?
I think it is. I do have a direct sense. And in fact, I was working on a student today with the C-sharp major prelude from book one of the Well-Tempered Clavier and the evenness it demands. And then my next student came and we were working on Beethoven and I could actually sort of feel that legacy of Bach realized in this Beethoven sonata. And of course, Beethoven also, as a young man, used to perform Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier. People say that Mendelssohn discovered it, but Beethoven knew it, Mozart knew it. And I do think it offers you this sort of technical foundation for the music that follows, as well as a musical foundation.
Who are your favourite Bach interpreters?
It's a good question. There are such a wide range of Bach interpretations, more so, I think, than any other composer just about. I love Gould. I love both versions of the Goldberg variations. I would never try to replicate Gould because that would just sound like caricature. But I love the sense of mind, the breadth of his mind and his playing and the absolute awareness of, you know, all these voices operating in stereo. I also really love the Bach playing of Richter. Actually, he horrified audiences by just on one concert tour only playing book one of the Well-Tempered Clavier. And that was quite an eccentric thing to do at the time. But there's, a beautiful classicism to his approach. And, I keep on coming back to his recording of that.
Well, we should listen to some Richter playing Bach. What'll it be?
Maybe we should start with number one, C major, the thing that everybody refers to later on. Chopin, Shostakovich.
Gounod.
Yeah, of course.
All right. That was Sviatoslav Richter playing the prelude and fugue from book one of the Well-Tempered Clavier by Bach. And my guest on the music show is the pianist and writer Anna Goldsworthy. And she's here in both capacities because she's written a book called Piano Lessons, which is a memoir of her own piano lessons. Gould, to return to Gould, of course, I mean, he was somebody who created a career for himself as a pianist, eschewing most of the repertoire, the obvious repertoire of pianists. I mean, he played all of Bach, but no Schubert, no Chopin, no Schumann to speak of, no Ravel, no Debussy.
I read him once saying that he felt he had a rather large blind spot that stretched from the Art of Fugue through to, I don't know, Schoenberg, which does seem like a rather large blind spot. And when sometimes if you do hear him playing Mozart or Beethoven, for me, those interpretations don't appeal nearly as much as his versions of Bach.
No. I agree. I mean, and in the case of some of those Mozart, I mean, he's setting out to prove that he's not very good.
Well, that's right.
Which is possibly not the best reason for making a record.
Yeah.
But that brings us to the rest of the repertoire and the other composers that are central for you. You've mentioned Chopin. You've mentioned Schumann.
Yeah. Central for me personally. At the moment, I'm on a Schubert kick. I just can't get enough Schubert. It's just it's just so utterly beautiful and so sweet in the very best sense of the word, and so poignant. When I hear Schubert, even when I hear the name Schubert, I feel like crying because this music is so evocative to me. That particular terrain, he travels somewhere between major and somewhere between minor. The way he's actually able to evoke ambivalence, which is so much a part of our emotional palette in life. I mean, and not that much music goes there, but he finds that place.
Yes, and now this is very personal music, isn't it? I mean, this is the opposite in a way of Bach.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Because you feel that this is his personality, which is pouring out through the keyboard.
Yeah.
Are you, when you play, I mean, we talked about how you've brought these characters, albeit real people, to life in your book. When you play the piano, are you doing something similar? Well, you're doing something similar for the music, I guess. Yeah. Are you doing it for the composer as well?
That's a good, it's an interesting question. I think creating a character in a book, you're looking at them from outside still, and you're looking at who that character is to you. When you're in a piece of music, you're actually on some level, and it sounds terribly hubristic, but I think what you're really trying to do is reincarnate that composer, if not their exact character, at least some of the emotional landscape of that piece. And so you're trying to approach Schubert, for example, from inside rather than looking at him from outside and saying, well, these might be his personality quirks, which I think is what I've done to some extent with the book, with the people in my life in the book. But at the piano, you're actually, or in music as a performer, you're trying to go somewhere deeper and really find out what makes these composers tick and find something in your own experience that you can recognise, or something in their experience that you can recognise in your own experience, and in that way bring it to life.
And you do this, it seems to me, in writing and in playing, in a rather similar way. I really felt reading the book that I was, I could hear your playing in the writing.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
It's kind of, I suppose it's sort of understated. It's not the exact word that I'm looking for, but in the case of the writing, for instance, often you will kind of write about some huge event in your life and you'll write about it very simply and you don't make a lot of it and the reader is left to think, oh, my God, you know, she's just got this fantastic new piano or the thing that she's wanted for so long, or she's just, you know, become the top in English in the whole state of South Australia, and she's making very little of it.
Yeah.
And you're left to sort of read between the lines.
Yeah.
Are you aware of playing the piano like that?
Like too? That. That's a very interesting point, you know, and no one's actually made that particular observation before. And I think, you know, Andrew, you're in a unique position, I think, and able to, you're able to look at the music from a practitioner's point of view, and you're also able to look at the words, I think, from a practitioner's point of view. So no one has made that remark, perhaps because no one has been qualified to look at both of those fields in quite the same way as you are. Is my piano playing understated in the same way? One aspect of Eleonora's playing that she's always, of her teaching that's always, she always emphasised to me growing up, was the importance of truthfulness in expression and of not what she called decorating, not being an interior decorator who goes through and makes everything look nice and look pretty, but shoring the music back, I suppose, to some sort of fundamental truth. I did find writing the book, I was dealing with particular dilemmas that I don't think are exactly translatable to the piano, one of which was my reflex to write self-deprecation, and also my satirical impulse, which is very easy for me to veer into satire in the writing, and I didn't really want to do that. Now, you can't quite do that at the piano, although when you're playing Prokofiev's Sarcasm, perhaps you should and perhaps you can, but for the most part, no. And so what I was consciously seeking in the writing of this book was finally to try and get rid of some of that self-deprecation, which ultimately is something to hide behind, and actually try to write something felt and something truthful, and I guess to dare to be earnest, you know, to dare to try to write wonder, to dare to write about joy, which are things that don't sit very comfortably always with perhaps with the Australian character, well, certainly with my character. Now, whether I feel the same at the piano, I don't think music makes sense if you don't allow yourself to experience wonder in music or experience joy in music.
Well, that was Maurizio Pollini playing the Etude Opus 10 No. 5 by Chopin. And my guest on today's music show is the pianist and writer Anna Goldsworthy, author of Piano Lessons. An etude is, as we've just heard, is full of bravura in that particular case. But it's also, by definition, a kind of teaching piece, isn't it? Even a concert etude like the one we've heard.
Yeah.
This business of practice, this is where I fell flat. I was so lazy. I had the piano lessons too, but yeah. I didn't improve because I wanted to be a pianist immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, and the idea of putting in the work never appealed to me.
Mm.
So technique, how do you teach technique? How do you practice? And what role do pieces like etudes play?
I think etudes play a tremendous role in growing as a pianist, and particularly a work like that. You know, the Chopin etudes are such sustaining works of music that you can prescribe them to your students, and you know that they're going to get so much out of them emotionally, and as well as at the same time working on their technique. I've never been fond of spending countless hours just doing exercises for the sake of moving your fingers. I know there are pianists who swear by that, and some of whom read a book as they fiddle away at the keyboard, but it seems to me that life is a little bit too short for that. And I find, and certainly the way Eleonora taught me as a child, the best way often to a technical solution, curiously enough, is through a musical intention. And often you'll find that if you're having a problem, some sort of physical problem with the piano, with playing a particular passage. It's actually just because you're not understanding it right, or you're not hearing it right, you're not processing it right. And then as soon as you just view it in a slightly different way, so many of those technical problems just evaporate. I read an interview with Vladimir Ashkenazy, I think, in which he said there's no such thing as a technical problem. It's only a pulse problem, a listening to the pulse problem. And I understand exactly what he means by that. It's about understanding what belongs to what.
Mm. But still, you've got to get it right.
Well, still, you do have to get it right. And you do, obviously, you do have to build up some sort of physical apparatus in order to be able to tackle this repertoire.
Yes, yes. And that's something that you have to keep going. That's the bit that can get rusty.
Oh, it gets rusty overnight. There's a quote that used to terrify me when I was a teenager that said, and I can't even remember who said this, but it goes something like, if a pianist doesn't practice for one day, the pianist knows it. If they don't practice for 2 days, the critics know it. If they don't practice for 3 days, everybody knows it.
Oh, yes, that is scary.
It is kind of scary. So it does demand constant maintenance. And I think, you know, being an honest musician does demand sitting down at your instrument and putting in the hours consistently.
How many hours do you practice?
Well, I shouldn't have said that because I knew that would be your next question. Since I had a baby, I've become much more of a dishonest musician. But I'm hoping to re-establish a bit more of a better practice regimen.
Let's go back to Anna Goldsworthy, the little girl. When did you know you were special?
I don't think I ever knew I was special. No, I don't think I ever sort of thought I was special.
All right, let me rephrase it. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of people in Australia having piano lessons at any given time.
Yeah.
An awful lot of people listening to you now are having piano lessons.
Yeah.
I mean, not at this exact moment. but they're not going to become professional pianists. There probably would be, I don't know, fewer than 100 people in Australia who make money out of playing classical piano at a very high level.
Mm.
So that's special. So when did you know that that was going to be you?
Look, I think I decided I wanted that to be me as a child without fully understanding the implications of that. When I started to believe that it might in fact be a possibility, it was a moment of great joy for me. It was my very first proper performance, I suppose, which was put on by this wonderful organisation in Adelaide called the Australian Society of Keyboard Music. And they still exist. They're now called Recitals Australia. And they used to, at that stage, organise Wednesday lunch hour concerts at a beautiful building on King William Street, Edmund Wright House. And I had my first concert there. It was only a 40-minute concert, but that was a very significant thing for me at the time. I think when I was about 15 and there was a terrific audience, my parents had mustered up a wonderful audience, and I found that a very moving and very affirming experience. And I think perhaps that was the moment when I thought, oh, yes, maybe this is what I should be doing and maybe I will be able to do it.
Well, but a lot of the book is about, and again, one is reading between the lines to some extent, but a lot of the book is about you as a little girl, as an adolescent, struggling with the fact that you are not like the other little girls and the other adolescents and kind of wanting to be and, you know, reading Dolly magazine and yet on the other hand knowing that you're not going to be.
I think that is part of, I suppose, the narrative that I tried to write, was that gradual dawning of awareness that no, I wasn't going to cut it as a cool kid. And I mean, that I suppose that particular phase of wanting that didn't last all that long, and renouncing that and actually sort of accepting my identity as a geek, and also increasingly as a musician, as a person who sort of lived and breathed music, that I suppose is essentially the story of this book.
And were you able, in a sense, to use your music eventually to kind of, you know, to show the others?
Oh, look, the others, whoever the others might be.
The cool ones.
I don't know if the cool ones would have been all that impressed by, you know, a list, Rigoletto paraphrase or whatever. So, look, I don't know if I've shown anyone. But I think I was able to show myself that this was something else I could do, and ultimately something that I think, obviously, I find much more important than being the cool kid at high school.
Yeah. But it's difficult for children, isn't it?
I think so. Look,
in that position.
Yeah, and I think it's probably difficult for most children, although some children are able to sail through adolescence without a moment of awkwardness or self-doubt, I suppose. But most of the people I spoke to, I think, went through similar things.
Yes, yes. What do you think music is for, ultimately?
What is music for? I think it connects us with our best selves. What is it for from an evolutionary perspective? It's a fraught question, and you know there is a range of answers ranging from sexual display through to a displaced sort of linguistic expression. I think music's a great mystery, and perhaps that's what makes it so compelling and what makes us keep on coming back to it and wanting more.
Anna Goldsworthy, thank you very much for being my guest on The Music Show.
My pleasure, Andrew. Thanks for having me.